Hi, and welcome to the Adult Forum. My name is still Paul Fromberg. Today is a special day because Margaret Lukens is here. Hiya. We are glad to be welcoming today Rick Fabian, who is a co-founder of St. Gregory's Church, who has a book that has just been published called Signs of Life, Worship for Just and Loving People. And we are recording this two ways. We're recording it both for the regular upload to the webpage and also for a new podcast, which I'm putting together. I can let you know that books are available for St. Gregory's folks. They're $15. And if you ask nicely,
big discount.
Rick will sign them.
Free.
For free. But any contributions you want to make to Rick's signature, we will gladly receive. Rick, welcome.
We mean St. Gregory's. We're gladly receive.
Correcto. Let me ask you a couple of questions. What inspired you to write this book?
Well, I started out writing an essay for a journal, which I will not name because the story is embarrassing for them. A major liturgical scholar invited me to respond to an attack on open communion. And so I wrote it, and the journal gave it out to very conservative, not to say reactionary, readers who dismissed it without ever addressing the argument at all. And the man who'd invited me to do this resigned from the – he was already rotating off the editing committee. But he was horrified and embarrassed and said, "You've got to write a book out of this." So it came out of surviving an attack.
So tell us about the book. Tell us something about the book.
The book gives us Donald is somewhere, I see him, and Ellen too. It opens with a nautical image in the introduction, and I want to assure you that I am not a sailor. Donald is, and we plotted a course across the ocean and plotted it for years, and this is the ship. This is the ship we designed to plot to follow this course, and you guys are trying to make this difficult for Paul to put this on a podcast. You guys are damn lucky that we have Paul for a rector with the ship today. A rector in Latin. You go ahead and applaud him. It's his 11th anniversary. And the rector in Latin, they tell you in seminary it means ruler and it's very politically wrong. No. Rector is an ordinary Latin word and it means the pilot of a ship. The captain of the ship is called gubernator in Latin. And the captain of our ship is on that cross. So the rector is the person whose job it is to pilot the ship in the direction that we have agreed the gubernator is going to lead us. And Paul has been piloting this outfit for 11 years now, and it is wonderful to be aboard, I'll tell you.
Thank you.
It's still on the same, certainly not the same exact course, but we're still headed for the same goal, the same harbor at the end. And not everybody is.
Thank you for that. That was lovely to hear. Appreciate your support. But I'm very curious about what your experience, being the rector of St. Gregory's, even before Donald and Ellen joined the experiment, what was that like for you?
Well, to begin with, it was historically it was a matter of selling the bishop on the idea, and he was anxious to find something for me to do because he ran out of money for paying me. So I picked up all the ideas that Donald and I had practiced at Yale and wrote them into a plan for St. Gregory's, which you can still read on the internet, and it functioned for years afterwards as a kind of constitution. It started out with all the people who came to St. Gregory's at the beginning were members of other churches who were helping us get started. It took us a year before we had people who came to St. Gregory's and stayed, as you are doing, most of you anyway. And it is a, what it was like at the beginning was always doing this with a group of people, unindicted co-conspirators. And it's still kind of like that. Yesterday, some of us came to a visioning day, and what I loved about the vision and is hearing all the co-conspirators talk. This place really is a collaborative enterprise, and for the reasons, the history I gave you, it has been since the start.
But you had a vision, along with Donald and Ellen, a vision of what this community would be like. The co-conspirators that you gathered along the way brought their own intelligence and their own experience. But I know that the book actually talks a lot about the substance of the vision, the sort of background and the academic stuff. But as a sort of a snapshot of the vision of St. Gregory's, how would you describe it back in the founding days?
The experimental part was putting directly into parish life ancient things that were once popular and no longer were, and modern criticism of the scriptures, modern criticism of theology and so forth, the debates that are going on, and largely this was a traditionalist, not reactionary, but radical view of what church tradition is like. So that was the effort was to see we could do this and it would work better than the standard stuff works.
Yeah. I love the title of the book, Signs of Life, and I love the subtitle, Worship for Just and Loving People. How did you choose this title?
Well, the title is supposed to suggest that the church might be lying prostrate and not many with no sign of breathing. But unless we can find some, it's supposed to suggest that a little inflation of the spirit might help it. And I have to say that once I put this picture, the guy on that editing committee loved it. The one I said you got to write a book. He loved this title. I learned only later, after it was accepted, that Martin Luther had a book by this title. So it's again, tradition speaks again.
The signs of life that you identify in the book are sort of beautifully contained within the structure of the chapters of the book, but also the stories that are laced through the narrative of the book. And some of those stories, you know, I feel like I've heard all of the stories that Rick Fabian has ever told, sort of a thing. And yet, I'm completely surprised by some of these stories. And I sort of wonder two things. One, where did you find some of these stories? And what is your favorite story that you included in the book?
I'll take the one that which was not in the original plan at all, but it appears in there. It's not my favorite story. It's just the remarkable story that happened. It's in the section on love beyond death, and which is the sign of marriage as a sign of love beyond death. And it has it's a story of, I was visiting, is our Hawaiian here?
Joan?
Joan, there she is. I was visiting her in order to interview her. This book ends with 10 interviews with active lay ministers. Don't leave it to the clergy to talk about beauty, because they don't. Get the lay ministers to talk about the experience of beauty in their work. And some of the lay ministers are here today. And one of them is Joan Roughgarden, who flew in from Hawaii. And you can ask her about what it was like, what it's like. Anyway, she invited me out to a picnic lunch with her new rector, who told me about being invited by a parishioner to come to her Buddhist husband's funeral. And funerals are the core of pastoral life in Pacific Ocean Buddhism. It's whatever brings everybody. If you are a really practicing Buddhist in China or Japan and so forth, you go to funerals a lot. And one of the rules is when the casket is actually lowered in the grave, everybody turns around and looks away while the monks lower it into the... So her rector turned around as dutifully, turned around and looked away, and she felt the abbot tap him on the shoulder, said, who whispered in his ear, turn around, you are worthy. So he did. This he did, and the abbot of Lihue and the rector of Lihue watched the man buried. That same year, our presiding bishop, a woman, was told at Lambeth that she may not wear her mitre because there are Anglican churches that don't have women bishops. So she was made to carry it while all the in procession. Well, and I figured there's a good contrast for you. The Buddhists know what authority is when they see it. The Anglicans are busy cutting off their hands and feet. And that's my favorite story in there.
I had a similar experience years ago. I was at an ordination, and the custom in the Episcopal Church, for those of you that don't know, is that when a priest is ordained, the other priests that are there join in laying hands on the ordinand. And one of the clergy that was there was a Methodist pastor who asked the rector of the church where the ordination was happening, where the ordinand had been sponsored, if he should participate. And the rector said, oh, no, I don't think so. And then the bishop looks at him and is like, just nods yes. Yes. So occasionally propriety gets bumped out of the way for the sake of the gospel.
The Church of England does not come through this book smelling terrific. So I was trained in England, and there are reasons why it's better to work here.
What is your... So you make a very strong point, especially in reference to the first chapter, I guess, where we're talking about what we call open communion or the open table or communion to the unbaptized or whatever it's called, which has become a bone of contention within the Episcopal Church, certainly. And you talk about that very intentionally, not as a practice which is based in a kind of common sense understanding of hospitality, but really in the sense of the gospel imperative that's read in the Jesus sayings and the narrative that's ascribed to the Jesus sayings throughout the Gospels. How did you come to understand at the time that you did a fairly countercultural understanding of what Jesus is saying about the open table?
Well, the study of the sayings of Jesus has been, or of Jesus' ministry and so forth, has been through a kind of revolution. And the liturgists have to be told about it. They don't know what's going. They haven't heard about it yet. So I figured that was one of the things that was my job to bring up in this book, is how the ministry of Jesus distinctively it guides us, and our view of his ministry has changed in some ways 180 degrees from what people thought it was 50 years ago even. So. And there aren't any, I don't hear voices like that raised in the debates about liturgical reform, so I decided to raise it.
Yep.
And there are, I think there's no point in following just our customs, especially if Jesus is going 180 degrees the other way. None of the ancient writers who favored baptism before communion, but none of them would ever have suggested we contradict Jesus. Which is the challenge the church faces here at this moment.
And I've heard sometimes, I've had conversations with liturgical scholars who have said, well, you know, Jesus said a lot of things.
And more is attributed to him than he actually said. This will happen to you, Paul.
Doubtful.
So, more of it, and one of the reasons, I decided not to spend any time in this book worrying of the question of which sayings are his and which are not and so forth. Especially for a guy 2,000 years ago who left no written stuff of his own behind, all portraits of Jesus are modern artifacts, including the ones that are called conservative. They are all made yesterday. And it is, so we have, there's a lot of sayings attributed to Jesus, and there's a fair amount of literature out there, books on the real Jesus and so forth, and they accept as authentic sayings, I wouldn't touch with a barge pole. And that's there. And I can say good reason why. In general, in principle, The critical principle is, if it serves the church's interest, then you can't say for sure that Jesus said that. Somebody else probably did. And if it's most often the ones that are a little embarrassing for the church, well, that's we can be sure. And one of those is on the altar. Is this guy hangs out with sinners and eats with them in an era when that was dangerous. He probably died for doing it. And the churches have been both positive and negative on this. On the one hand, there's Isaac of Nineveh saying, Jesus hung out with whores and tax collectors, so don't distinguish. Let everybody, serve everybody the same. And on the other hand, there are people who think only people qualified with this kind of belief and so forth should eat at the table, which is just, well, you read that chapter one. If you read the chapter one, you'll see what the implications of Jesus' ministry as we understand it are. But in favor of the open table is the church's unwavering tradition. This may be the only ritual meal in the world where all the diners are officially declared unworthy to eat every time they eat.
You've taught, you've written, you've spoken, you've preached, you've had conversations with people about so much that's contained in the book. I found that reading the book was sort of like having a conversation with you, like having a conversation with an old friend, where a lot of what you present is, it's sort of like finally all in one place. Somebody said it was like somebody had gone into the basement of the British Museum and pulled everything out and put it all together in a place where you can see it all in one moment. I wonder, though, if there was something in writing the book that really surprised you, something that you learned that surprised you in writing the book.
Yes. Donald has observed that he thinks the most interesting feature of this book is I propose the signs of life. There are like, how many, 10 chapters. There are, the Latin church says seven sacraments, because they like seven. The Greeks refuse to say how many. The Latin tradition is to base everything on the Renaissance fights about the Eucharist. So you take the Eucharist as the center one and try to make the other ones look like it. And I proposed nowadays the current fashion is to make baptism the central sacrament. And I'm proposing, no, marriage. And marriage is there's plenty, I don't say in this, but it's, the Bible is full of marriage and talks about baptism this much. And it's, and certainly there is not, marriage has a lot going for it as a central sacrament for thinking about all our ritual actions. For one thing, it's everywhere. So everybody can relate to it. And the second thing is it gives primary, not exclusively, but primary power to the factor of desire. Desire is not enough raised in studies of Christian pastoral theology. The only, as it happens in the Book of Common Prayer, the only one, the 1549 book, the only one asks about desire is baptism. What do you desire? Baptism. Will you be baptized? I will. It's the only time it appears. And nowadays, you know, if you go to a ceremony, if you're not a member of this church, you go to the ceremony when something has happened. What you want to know is: do the people going through this, do they really want this? They're my friends. Do they want this? That's what matters.
That's a fascinating insight. It actually gives a framing for the dozens or hundreds or thousands or millions of sacraments that flow through our lives, and the basis of desire is a beautiful optic through which to consider it all. I think it's interesting to consider, since marriage has become an optic through which to look at sacramental life, interesting to consider what the enfranchisement of gay and lesbian people and having same-sex marriage has meant in relationship to a lot of the worship life of the church, including the open table. I sort of wonder if there is some connection between the open table and same-sex marriage. in the sense of we're not as concerned about, quote, purity as we are about where God is in the moment, where God's desire is in the moment.
Well, the churches differ on what on describing marriage. Hmm. What's essential and what's not, and in the ceremony and so on. The distinctive feature, I've just forgotten your question.
Yeah. It wasn't a very good question.
I wanted to answer it, and I can't remember what you asked.
What's the connection sort of between the open table and same-sex marriage?
Oh, same-sex marriage. Funny, I should forget that. I think what's happening, it's a sign of how the churches have changed their view of what's essential and required in it.
Yeah.
And they're... in general, the principal image, the principal doctrine of marriage is blessing. Mm. That it is a blessing in Hebrew, baruch, means better things than you could ever have calculated, beyond all reasonable calculation. And it works, and not only for you. If you've translated "blessed" in the Beatitudes, "blessed are the poor," and so forth, the Greek says "makarios," which means happy. But it's not happy for you. Baruch means for everybody. Having a blessing means you bring blessing to those around. It just that's how it happens. The good things come to those around you, and you can't explain why. Mm. It's outside of the calculus that you could make.
Yeah, that certainly is, at least. From my perspective, that certainly is an experience of liturgy here at St. Gregory's, where I can show up in a grumpy mood, which is not unusual, and then all of a sudden in the midst of the prayer of the people around the table say, something happens. Something is confected or constructed or flowing around us that transforms me and us. And I wonder if you know, I love hearing your stories. I love hearing all of your stories. I wonder if there's an experience of your own where you learned more about the power of the liturgy, where you learned more about that sort of transformative or connecting power of liturgy.
Yes. I am a convert to the Great Entrance. You will read about it in this book. It's very obvious if you go to an Eastern church. The Armenians do it very simply, but it's what we have been calling for the last 50 years the offertory. The offertory is the wrong name for what happens, but you now understand. You know what I'm referring to: the bringing the bread and wine to the table, and then we're going to pray over them. And sometimes there is money included, but a lot of the writing about it teaches what we bring. Good sacramental theory does not depend on what we bring, but on what God does. Mm-hmm. So what happens in the Great Entrance procession, which became the biggest thing in worship at Hagia Sophia. It took 600 clergy to do it, and could take 2 hours on a feast. Aren't you lucky that we take through this faster here? And but it's still the dramatic core of Eastern Church worship, including the simple Armenian form of it. And it is the place where Christ comes here and now. Now, coming here and now in this service, this is the center of Jesus' recovered preaching. Is the kingdom of God is not in the future. It's already here. You better respond now or you're going to be in the soup. Mm. And we do have, fortunately, people have been writing about the pagan, Roman, and Hellenistic sacrificial processions where you cover the animal with flowers and then you take it somewhere and kill it. And that makes, as if that were a kind of portrait of what we're doing. We're about to give thanks for Jesus' death at the end of the procession. But if you read the Byzantine hymns for this, they don't mention anything like that. They talk all about the original refrain is, "Lift up your heads, you gates, and be lifted up, you everlasting doors, and the King of glory will come in." Who is this? The Lord of hosts, he is the King of glory. And it expanded into five extended hymns, which you can find at different churches. But and I propose that we have those hymns to use. We don't have to go to and copy them. We have all those hymns, we just don't use them. And so included at no extra charge in your purchase of this book is a list of, count them, 222 beloved hymns of ours, which do this if you want to use them. And bring, it's in the, there's, look, there, our sales force are hoping and holding it up right now. And you will go read those, any of those texts. They fit perfectly with Eastern Church worship, what the Eastern Churches do, a more conservative text. And so we have a model for this. So I publish it in the book. A non-liturgical model. It's in the book and the photograph of it. There in the photograph is Martin Luther King and Archbishop Jacobos leading the second march. Actually, they led the photographs of the memorial service afterward, of the marches in Selma. And after it was over, King was shot, but Jacobos, and he speaks up in the pages of this book, talks about what it meant to him to do those marches. And he's, for 30 years after that, he could remember that experience of leading that march to justice. Every Sunday, when he carried the body and blood of Christ to the altar table, the kingdom come. And so, and I'm a convert to that as the core of the service. The Eucharist, prayer, and Thanksgiving are, of course, the bedrock. But what it all means is coming now. For those who care about looking for the second coming, the Eastern tradition is, yes, the second coming is happening this Sunday at 10 o'clock in your parish. Be there. So
it seems like so much of the liturgy is really what you described, that lift up your heads. In other words, pay attention to what's happening, because it is happening. It's not something you have to figure out or that you have to intellectualize, but you just have to look.
Yes, exactly.
It strikes me that so often the arguments that we get into around the liturgy and the renewal of the liturgy and the revision of the prayer book and all that other stuff is about text, about words, and not about action. One of the things I'm curious about is how you see, for example, the words of the Book of Common Prayer as both a promise and a challenge to the effecting of liturgy that transforms life.
Well, without getting into a minute discussion of phrases in the prayer, in the 1549 book and 1552, all the stuff and what has happened to all of them, I think the real gift of the Book of Common Prayer is that it set for us what rhetorical prose would be in English. It was not clear when that was written what rhetorical prose would be. The argument and the rhetorical feet, the rhythms, all that stuff are now set for us. The authorized, so-called authorized version of the King James Bible, was neither authorized nor did King James have anything to do with it. That was deliberately antique. It was deliberately made to put into the English your grandparents spoke. But not the 1549 prayer book was an attempt to put the best classical style into everybody's speech and everybody's, and that's the big gift comes from the prayer book, is the language and the persuasiveness of that rite, whatever it is changed with it, and it changes various theories. If you hold up just for a second, this word signs. One of the advantages of choosing this title, Signs of Life, is I'm presenting here none of the rituals are actually rituals where we do something. The signs are where we recognize what God is doing everywhere in the world, not just in churches. And if these are the signs that tell us what God is up to everywhere already, without our help, without our authorization. And I'll tell you, my only problem with God is she never takes my advice. I have a So it's recognizing all of these rituals show us what God is doing everywhere, and that's the Book of Common Prayer began that by making it evident to everybody who walked into the building what God is doing here. That had not been evident except to the people who read Latin beforehand. Now the Greeks, a different problem. They had perfectly understood language, and the Russians mistranslated it. But that's all right. The Western Church, from which we descend and have most of our gifts, actually, was for only some people to understand what was going on. If you read the devotional materials of the time, the devotional matters have nothing to do, by and large, with the ritual signs.
I want to talk a little bit about the place where we're seated today, St. Gregory's Church. Every time I walk in, I am astonished by what the community has accomplished over the more than 40 years of its existence, and then the years before, where you were devising and imagining community in new forms as the chaplain of the Episcopal Church at Yale. One of the things I'm curious about is, if you were starting St. Gregory's today, what might you do differently than you did before? I told you they're going to be hard questions.
No, that's it. I have occasionally asked myself this question, because some of the struggles we worked through took longer than anybody expected they would. And I think that's what I would do, is I'd look at the history of the place and see what took the longest. The longest thing, for example, the longest part of the original plan for St. Gregory's to establish was service. And the pattern of service was the last one we got actually running. And I think if I were starting over again, I would hit that one first in getting people to talk about it. Mm-hmm. That's what's missing. It was planned not that we would do a certain project, but we'd get everybody talking about it. Mm-hmm. And we just didn't get it talking about it enough. So I think that's what I would do differently.
What would the effect of that talking about service be, do you think?
Well, they'd send me a lot of money, I hope. What would the effect of being? I think it would be something like people recognizing that church is where we can talk about it, which is the purpose. I feel like I'm going to spoil this book experience by telling you that the liturgy, the Bible tells you what the liturgy is, what worship is for. I'm going to spoil it, because it's a secret revealed at the end of the book. The Bible tells you what liturgy is for. Forget that I said you. It's told you. It's for God speaking to us. That's why we do all this stuff. And as Ralph Kiefer said once, the Word of God is not the Bible. The Word of God is what God says to the church when the Bible is read. Now, that's true about all of the stuff we do. It's all here for God to speak to us. And I think if we got people talking about service, we would hear from God.
I'm going to ask you one more question, and then I'm going to see if there are any questions from the congregation.
Yes.
I'm going to ask you one more question first.
Yeah.
Rick, what is your next book?
Well, this experience has been like, it took me 2 years of writing and editing, and I felt like an elephant in the 22nd month of pregnancy waiting for the calf to drop. And I wonder if the elephant cow ever has another calf. I suppose they do.
I'm sure that we could find an answer to the question.
All I know about it is that not only that it takes 22 months, but that the elephant gives birth standing up, and the calf simply comes out bang out of the ground like that. St. Gregory's did not come out like that.
I love that. All right, let's take some questions. Linda?
What do you mean precisely by service?
What do you mean by service?
What would you mean by it? That's what, see, that's what we need. No, no, don't take it. I've just got a couple of academic degrees. Forget it. What do you mean by it? That's the conversation we need to have.
Within the church, without the church, all of that.
We need to have that conversation, yes.
Service in the total sense, not just liturgical.
You tell
service.
Me.
Well, what do you mean when you were using it in terms of?
I was just using it in the total, in not in the. Well, all right. I hazard a definition for the word liturgy in this book. In the early 20th century, the campaign was to call liturgy the work of the people, and therefore not just of the clergy. But in Hellenistic usage, it meant what a rich person does for the common good, like Davies' Symphony Hall. That is liturgy in the sense of what the word came to mean, not the church's meaning. So liturgy is what God is, what is when, where we join in what God does for the world's good. Mm-hmm. We join in. That's what it is, and it's our part in it.
Mm-hmm. Beth.
What if what you see here looks like what you imagined, and what doesn't look like what you imagined?
Well, the T-shirts, for one. what else can I say? What looks like I mean? This is pretty well it. I must say that I think that our rector's icon of the crucifixion is one of the finest things we've got around here. Of course, it's based on a destroyed icon in Florence, destroyed during the flood. And so we are lucky to have this memorial, a great example of classical tradition coming to life today. And it is, so what, but all of those people dancing up there, that is, I took that image from the Louvre. If you go to the Louvre, and if you're tired of standing up in a great crowd to squint at the Mona Lisa, you can turn right and go to the room next door where the Botticellis and stuff like that are on the wall, like the way they used to display in the Renaissance. The way people displayed paintings was like postage stamps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, like that all over. And one of them is the Nativity, with the creche is there with Jesus and Mary and Joseph and all that. And overhead is a series of angels whirling in a dance overhead. Of course, it's a sort of tarantella. They are ecstatically crazy up there. I decided to adapt the Russian idea of the saints all standing around, which is probably Buddhist, and it is... The origins for that are probably Buddhist Central Asian. And they're, so I decided we'll have them dance like us and we'll dance with them.
We call the ring dance of the angels.
Please say that louder.
I think it's called the ring dance of the angels.
The ring
Thank
dance
you.
Of the angels.
Ring dance.
Libby, and then.
Who or what is God to you?
Who or what is God to you?
This is a serious answer, though it will not sound like it. I was once put on a jury, and in the jury it was a domestic violence case, and we watched as in the jury room as the men in the jury rocketed back and forth romantically. He's lying, she's lying. He's telling the truth, she's telling the truth, like that. It went back and forth. It's the Asian women on the jury who were really skeptical of everything they heard, and we ended up, all of us, voting with the Asian women. So who is what God is? My picture of God is five Chinese women. And, if I'm ever had up for a crime I think I didn't commit, if I think I was innocent, I will tell my lawyer to be sure to get as many Asian women as possible onto the jury. That's my picture of God.
Yes.
Yeah, I just did some rapid research and found that a mother elephant will have up to 12 different
Whoa. One more book. You see?
There's a picture of popular demand. Because it was ancient, Donald and I resurrected it at Easter time at Yale. And it happened that our first service at St. Gregory's in San Francisco was March 9th, Gregory's feast day. And because we were at rented quarters and we couldn't use it the next week, the next time we got it was Easter, was the service. And so we danced at Easter. And the next Sunday came up, and we didn't suggest it. And all the people said, "Why aren't we dancing?" So we've been dancing ever since.
Rick, I can't tell you how much your presence in this community means to us all. You're, in addition to being an inspiration to me as the current leader of St. Gregory's, you are an inspiration not only to the people in this room, but to people across the globe who give a care about the future of the dance that we all participate in following Jesus. And I'm so grateful for your book. If you have not read it yet, I encourage you to do so. It is a masterpiece. I'd like to ask all of you to express your affection for Rick with applause.
The book is a common product. Donald and Eleanor write, if you read, don't finish the book without reading the thank yous at the end. For one thing, you will get an actual vision of God at the very end of it. Do that. And it's a common product. We all created this book. I just wrote down, like, is that what Mary Baker Eddy said that she did?
Joseph Smith.
And Muhammad.
And Muhammad.
So we're doing what you guys believe.
Rick will be signing books over here. If you'd like to purchase one, if you brought one with you, Rick will probably sign that one too. Thank you all so much. We'll see you next week.
Don't just buy for yourself. This is the perfect.